Joining us now is Randall Ray, who's a professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, as well as a research director at the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability and senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute of Bard College in New York. His books include Understanding Modern Money, The Key to Full Employment and Price Stability, Money and Credit in Capitalist Economies, and his latest book is Modern Money Theory, a Primer on Macroeconomics for Sovereign Monetary Systems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Randall Ray.
Hi.
And obviously we've been watching with some bemusement perhaps, but largely with horror at the dysfunction of our federal government as the Congress convened over the Christmas break without dealing with this so-called fiscal cliff that they've invented as a crisis. Then they've walked away from it, and even the Speaker himself was humiliated by his own Tea Party caucus, who went to the mat for the millionaires and billionaires. Heavens forbid that they should pay more in taxes. I'm speaking with, I think, evident disgust, but tell me how you feel about it, Randall Ray.
Yeah, well, the whole thing looked orchestrated from the very beginning. Everyone remembers the debt limit debate and Republicans refusing to go along with raising that without some kind of fiscal cuts and moving toward balanced budgets and all that. And so they postponed the whole thing by creating this fiscal cliff. And it looked to me like the whole purpose of this was to give the Democrats cover for cutting popular social programs. But finally, they come down to the very end here. And I think the Democrats probably would have given in on that, the Republicans just would not give in on tax increases at all, and the whole thing fell apart.
Well, one of the things that worries me, and I spoke the other day with Jeffrey Sachs about this, he's equally concerned, is that whether it's Obama's plan or Boehner's plan or a combination of both, they will cut the discretionary spending part of the budget down to its lowest level since the Eisenhower administration. And effectively what you'll have left is a government that is a war machine and a pension plan. And the whole point of discretionary spending, that's all of the other things that make life worthwhile and gives government purpose and is the measure of our civilization. That's what they're cutting to the bone.
That is extremely troubling. I saw those numbers too. Effectively, we're going to get rid of everything except Social Security, which I think will be cut significantly, Medicare, which will be cut significantly, and then the military. So it's really, really shocking that we're going to go, well, we're already partway into this century, but we're going to do this without funding for education, without funding for research, without funding for a transportation system that we need. We got one in the 50s and 60s, and we've basically done nothing since then. It's just shocking that our politicians, elected representatives, are willing to go this route.
So, I take it that you would agree with me that the American people don't know what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, you know, creating this deficit hysteria, and deficits sound scary, and you get the far right wing, the Pete Peterson-funded people talking about $70 trillion of unfunded commitments and so on. So the population is scared. I think that, you know, this is an application of the shock doctrine. Let's shock them with these huge numbers, and then we can get what we want. So I think that that's a big part of the story. They're scared. And then the other part of the story is that the whole public discussion is about really non-issues at all. And no one is focusing on it, what it really means to go through this next century with no federal support for all the stuff that we need in order to remain competitive in a global economy.
So again, I'm speaking with Randall Ray, who's a professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, as well as a research director at the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability and a senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute of Bard College in New York. His latest book is Modern Money Theory, a Primer on Macroeconomics for Sovereign Monetary Systems. So what is it going to take then, Randall Ray, to wake up the American people? Apparently our press is not doing anything about it. They've just gone along with this phony framing of a fiscal cliff and turned it into a piece of cheap theatrics. They're just interested in talking about process and not context and results. The president seems to be more interested in being a backroom negotiator than having a debate with the United States and its people. I mean, you'd think that instead of these ad hoc emergency deals where every time the debt limit has to be raised, the Republican Tea Party has a tantrum and holds the whole full faith and credit of the United States at hostage, and we limp along as a result of that from crisis to crisis. Don't you think it requires, you know, an economic vision, that somebody ought to step up and say, you know, this is what we should be doing? We're the richest country on earth, and it's just an absolute crime that we are involved in these self-inflicted wounds, because we're a healthy economy on the mend, but these clowns in Washington are shooting us in the foot.
You mentioned President Obama, and although he has said some good things in the past couple of weeks, he bears a lot of responsibility. During his first campaign and all through his first term in office, he kept saying the federal government has run out of money. He kept saying, I'm sorry, but there's nothing we can do. We've run out of money. I mean, this is just absolutely a false statement. It's very misleading, and it added to the fear that the public has, oh, no, our federal government has run out of money. You know, it cannot happen. It's a sovereign government. It can't possibly run out of money. No more than the scorekeeper at Fenway Park can run out of runs to award to the Boston Red Sox. The money is it's a scorekeeping thing. That's what I'm trying to emphasize in this book, trying to explain how the government actually spends. It credits accounts, and this shouldn't be, it's not controversial. I mean, this is a description of the way the government actually spends, but it also shouldn't be scary to the public. And so I think it's just irresponsible of Obama to talk about running out of money. And of course, the second thing that he's done all along that's absolutely terrible is protected Wall Street. And Wall Street did create a real crisis. Now, the deficit, the government debt, that is not a real crisis. Wall Street created a real crisis, and we've done nothing about that.
Well, you would think then that the public would, would be up in arms because they don't know how bad it is, and they don't know how much of their government's going to be eviscerated. But I think one of the things that keeps them sort of ignorant, if you will, is this argument over taxes and the belief that we pay too much in taxes, which we don't, and we don't have a debate about what we get back for our taxes, which is how the social democracies in Europe and other countries operate. So it seems to me that Obama is playing along with that in not wanting to tell the American people that it's not just the millionaires and billionaires who should pay more taxes. Everybody should. We're way down in terms of our revenues.
Well, yes. The problem is that since about 1974, average Americans have seen no increase whatsoever in their income. And for the bottom half of the population, their income in real terms is actually lower now than it was. Americans are not used to living through way more than a generation with no improvement at all in their standard of living, except by going into debt. And so the way that the average American looks at this is that, okay, my income is not increased. I got heavily into debt. Now I'm underwater in my mortgage, and you want to raise taxes on me? They believe, and I think with justification, that they're overburdened high gasoline prices and so on, and they can't afford higher taxes. So the solution for most Americans is we need jobs, we need wages to increase, and then we could ask them to pay more taxes. Now, of course, I'm not now talking about the very top, the top 1%, or possibly the top 3 or 4%, who've had just tremendous, unbelievable increases of their income, and at the same time, tremendous, unbelievable reduction in their taxes. And, of course, that is who the Tea Party and the Republicans in general are protecting from any tax increase. And so I think I'm agreeing with most of your story, but not quite all of it. So if we could get jobs and if we could get people some decent mortgages that they could afford, and if we can get them wage growth, then I would agree that we need to take more than the current 17% or so of income on average in taxes.
Well, of course, everything you're saying is the opposite of the notion of austerity, and that's what the Republicans and Pete Peterson, the Wall Street billionaire, who's the major deficit hawk, they're pushing that line that we have to tighten our belts, except the rich don't have to tighten their belts, and that's the deep unfairness of it. And if they go the austerity route, we've seen what happened in Europe. It's a catastrophe for everybody except the super rich. So where is the low-hanging fruit then in terms of, obviously, you shouldn't tax the middle class at this point at all because of the state of the economy and it hasn't come back. But in terms of at least doing something about revenues. And one of the ironies is that going off the fiscal cliff will actually do something about revenues more than these negotiations that they're doing. So, you know, they're going to do more damage to the discretional budget, what's left of it, through negotiation than would happen with us going off the fiscal cliff.
Yeah, well, I think it's very hard to come up with a justification for not allowing the tax rates on the richest Americans to go back up. In other words, let that part of the Bush tax cuts expire. It's just hard to make an argument that they should not be paying higher tax rates when we have a presidential candidate who's a multimillionaire who pays a lower tax rate than, his lowest paid secretary. There's obviously something wrong with that. So, yes, I agree with that. I think that most of our focus, though, should be on trying to save the important programs. Social Security, which has been under attack, and unfortunately the Democrats have gotten on board with the attacks. Medicare, why do the conservatives and Wall Street, which has bought a lot of the Democrats, hate Medicare so much? Because it offers a shining example of the kind of medical care system we could have for all Americans. It works, it's efficient, it's very cheap. That's why they want to cut it. And then the other thing we were talking about, it's crazy to reduce spending on education, on our infrastructure that's falling down, and that is falling behind first-class world standards. So I would focus more of my anger on the spending. Let's get the economy under recovery. And then if we need to raise taxes on everyone below the top 2% or so, then we can talk about that at that time.
So is there any reason for us to hope that we're going to get real? There's going to be a real discussion as opposed to this phony posturing over this completely trumped up fiscal cliff?
It's very hard to see where that would come from. I think what people are probably very worried about the January 2nd date. It's looking likely that there will be some kind of a stopgap measure President Obama has talked about extending the unemployment benefits for the long-term unemployed instead of letting that expire. So that could well happen. I think it's important to extend the unemployment benefits. There aren't obviously jobs for those long-term unemployed, so it doesn't make sense to cut their unemployment benefits and, you know, reduce them to living in the streets. So I think we're going to get some postponements. The president wants to let the tax cuts expire on those above $250,000. Maybe that has some chance of going through. I don't know. But the fact is, we're not going to fall off a fiscal cliff. The gradually, there will be some fiscal headwinds as tax rates go back up. If the payroll taxes go back up, that's going to hit every working American. But it's, you know, it's a sort of a gradual cutting into their take-home pay, so that the economy will very gradually slow down if we go over the cliff. Some people are worried about the ratings agencies downgrading us, as if ratings agencies have any idea of what they're doing, especially when it comes to rating creditworthiness of sovereign governments that cannot be forced into default. I think markets already understand that the credit ratings make absolutely no difference whatsoever for a sovereign country like the U.S. So at most, we're going to see the stock market go down for a day or two, and then it'll go right back up when they realize it's much ado about nothing. So I don't think going over the cliff is anything like, you know, jumping off a cliff. It'll be a very gradual erosion that could push us back into recession.
Again, I speak with Randall Ray, who's a professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, as well as a research director at the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability and a senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute of Bard College in New York. He's the author of the new book, Modern Money Theory, a Primer on Macroeconomics for Sovereign Monetary Systems. So if a deal is made, of course, you know, Boehner, I think, is pretty much finished. He's got so many knives in his back. So it's a wonder the guy, he's starting to look like a character out of Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. He's probably going to have whatever he'll deliver it with the Democratic votes. So that's going to be a heavy lift, isn't it?
So what has to happen is that the voters have to let their representatives know, especially the Democrats, that they don't want any grand betrayal there. They don't want to see the retirement ages lifted. They don't want to see benefits cut through changing the way that the inflation is calculated for the purposes of the cost of living adjustments. Because I think that the most likely scenario is the Democrats are going to give in on those things, and that leads to lower living standards for today's and tomorrow's seniors. So that's what needs to be stopped.
So again, I guess we're hoping that the sleeping giant awakes. No indication, but do you think that? I mean, the worst part of this is that they announce the deal after it's made, and they vote on it, and then the public find out how much they've been screwed.
Unfortunately, that could well happen. It's very hard to get the public focused on something that is hard to understand in an atmosphere of crisis, and where most of the effects are going to come on very gradually and largely in the future. So that, I mean, we can do a deal such as we won't raise the retirement age for anyone who's under age 30, anyone over age 30, so that it's only the young people who are going to get what effectively is a benefit cut, and it's far in the future. So those are the kinds of cuts they probably are going to make, and it's very hard to get people up in arms about that. I mean, not in the literal sense, but
sure.
I mean, trying to prevent the policymakers from doing that. Because if you do surveys of young people, many of them have already become convinced that they're not going to be able to collect Social Security anyway because of all of this hysteria about the program going bankrupt.
Well, I was going to say just in the last couple of minutes here, Randall Ray, the whole thing is so bogus, though. When Pete Peterson and the deficit hawks say the sky is falling, and we are, it's true that if nothing is done, the debt will become unsustainable. But that doesn't mean that fixes aren't within reach and that don't have to be so damaging to the recovery. The rest of the world, meanwhile, is buying our debt with great enthusiasm. So the idea that we're going broke is just absolutely a lie.
Sure. Whenever there's a crisis, everyone runs into U.S. government debt, knowing that it's the safest thing you can buy on the whole planet. Let me say that the Pete Peterson-funded groups that do these debt calculations through infinite horizons, and they come up with numbers like $70 trillion, this stuff is all just funny calculations. None of this stuff is actually ever going to happen. Nothing fundamental has really changed with regard to the federal government's budget. The reason why we have a $1 trillion budget deficit, it's actually gone down in the past year, is because the economy is so terrible. Now, the economy is not going to be terrible for the next 50 to 70 years, which is what it would take to get these calculations of extremely high debt ratios and growing debt ratios through infinity. When we recover, the budget deficit is automatically going to go down. The overall stance of the federal government's budget has not changed significantly in the past decade. And although we are an aging society, we already are pretty much there. The changes to the budget that will occur over the next 30, 40, 50 years due to demographics are not big. We're talking about shifting 2% more of GDP through the Social Security program to the aged in the future. It's a 2% shift. It's tiny in the big scheme of things. So it's just not true that we have a fundamentally unsustainable budget stance.
Well, Randall Ray, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Randall Ray, as a professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, as well as a research director at the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability, and a senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute of Bard College in New York. His latest book is Modern Money Theory, A Primer on Macroeconomics for Sovereign Monetary Systems. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about the good news in the future and the bad news in the present.
Money makes the world go around. round, the world go round, the world go round. Money makes the world go round, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound, a mark, a yen, a buck or a pound is all that makes the world go round. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now on Christmas Day is Stephen Schwartz, who is a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research. He is also the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, and other publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Schwartz.
Merry Christmas to you, Ian.
Thank you. And I wanted to talk to you on this day about things that are very hopeful and cheery and bright, merry and bright, if you will, and things that are dark and ominous and things that we have to deal with as a culture, obviously the latter being what just happened with the slaughter of school children in a school in Connecticut. But let's begin with a recent report put out by the National Intelligence Council at the CIA on Global Trends 2030, looking ahead to the world in 2030. And by and large, it was actually fairly optimistic, although I don't think it dealt sufficiently with the challenges because of global warming and whether they'll be met. But it more or less says that the world in 2030 is going to be essentially divided up between China and the United States will be the two hegemons, and that they will basically compete with each other economically but not militarily, and that the United States economy will come booming back as a result of energy self-sufficiency. What did you take from that report?
Well, I agree with it in the sense that I believe we have moved out of the old bipolar world of the Soviet Union and the United States. We've been in a kind of interregnum for the last, since 91. I think it's very clear that we are moving into a multipolar geopolitical reality, which is going to be much more complicated in a sense than the one we grew up in. China and the United States, I think, are definitely going to be at the top of the food chain, but I believe other countries like Brazil, which will soon surpass Great Britain, and Russia will also be major players. The one thing that I noticed in that report, two things actually that struck me. One was they did not really deal with the rise of the virtual corporate state, which I believe is really the most geopolitically important thing that's happening, that just as nation states developed at the end of the 19th century in the configuration we mostly know, we are now moving into a world in which non-geographical corporate states, which multinationals, which function essentially as countries but without geography, and which increasingly control elected legislatures as vassals. You can see this, I think, in that recent event of those children being killed. I mean, the reason we have the gun laws that we have is that large corporate interests, how can we delicately put this, own the Congress, influence the Congress to vote in certain ways in this area. And as a result, even though if you own an automobile, you know, you have to be trained, you have to be licensed, you have to be insured. And we have thousands of men and women in uniform roaming the highways to enforce those laws. When it comes to guns, we don't require any of those things. And consequently, we have the kind of events that we have seen, not just recently in the murder of these school children in Newtown, but you know, as the president noted, there have been four major ones in his administration, in the first administration, and that says nothing about the general killing that goes on in cities all across the United States that don't get a lot of media attention. I mean, the rise of the virtual corporate state, in whether it is dealing with industrial agriculture and GMOs, or whether it is dealing with energy and fracking, for instance, all of them seem to suggest that profit is more important than national wellness. And that, I think, is something that they really did not capture in that report.
Well, they're also, you know, of course, we're witnessing the fiscal follies on Capitol Hill, and at the heart of those of these machinations going on, and the humiliation of the speaker by his own party, by the zealots in his own party, at the heart of all that, of course, is the issue of taxation. And it looks like these Tea Party types will go to the mat for millionaires and billionaires, which is an extraordinary revelation of their fealty to wealth and how much the Congress has been is owned by the oligarchs in this country. But when you're looking for revenues, which is what, you know, Obama's going to have to do, and what Boehner's going to have to do, and what the country's going to have to do, because we're the least taxed country amongst the advanced democracies, and we are simply not raising enough money to pay for a government commensurate with our status. And, of course, that's a challenge in itself, because there are crazies on the right that want to shrink the government down to the size where, as Grover Norquist said, you can drown it in a bathtub. This is a long-winded way to get to the point, Stephen Schwartz, which is that in terms of corporate taxation, not just the corporate power, the virtual corporate state, but, for example, I'll give you an example. Pfizer has the formula for Viagra, which they stumbled on as a result of research into fenfen. And then so Pfizer New Jersey then sends that formula across to Pfizer Switzerland, which they put in a vault. And then Pfizer Switzerland pretends that they are the owners of Viagra. So all of the massive profits going into Pfizer then go, you know, even though they're kept in a bank in New York, they're posted in Switzerland as a Swiss company. And they don't pay any U.S. corporate taxes. That's just an example of the way that these multinationals dodge their social responsibility and how capital has transcended nationalism.
Yes, I agree with this, what you're saying, Ian. It is very clear, you cite the Pfizer case. You could also look at Monsanto and what they're doing in terms of GMOs and the threats that have been issued against a variety of researchers when their results don't support the safety of GMOs, the suicides in India by Indian farmers. I mean, it goes on and on and on. What I think both of us are trying to say is that in a world that is structured solely to create profit with no consideration for national wellness, these kind of situations that arise are not aberrations. They are, in fact, exactly what you would expect if the only consideration that you have is the making of profits. I think the big challenge that is coming, and I believe the other thing that the CIA report did not, I believe, fully address, was the impact of climate change. I think what we're going to see in the coming decades is a real struggle to make national wellness a priority. That's what most Americans want. I mean, they articulate it differently, I think. You know, you want specifics. But generally what people are trying to get to is a society in which national wellness, that is, wellness of the individual, wellness of the family, wellness of the community. That's what's driving the thriving and resilient community effort that's going on all over the country and indeed all over the world, and the wellness of the planet. there is an instinctive awareness, I think, amongst just regular people that something is deeply awry and that the priorities of society have become perverted so that individuals are basically all too many times just little valves to get at the public treasury. I mean, you see it in the privatization of prisons, the privatization of schools, the school-to-prison trend that's developing in this country. The big challenge we've got, and I think Christmas Day is a good time to talk about that, is are we prepared to make national wellness our first priority?
Well, the answer might well be, and I hate to say this, Stephen Schwartz, that the if you look at these budget negotiations between the White House and John Boehner, whoever's plan or a combination of both plans is finally agreed on, assuming it is, the discretionary budget of the United States Treasury will shrink to its lowest level since the Eisenhower years. And effectively, what we'll have for a United States government is essentially a war machine and a pension plan. And all of the things that you're talking about that make civilization worthwhile and make a society worthwhile, the government agency that inspects food, the FAA that makes sure that planes don't crash, etc., they will be stripped to the bone. That's the trajectory we're on.
Absolutely. And not only are we on that trajectory, but we are beginning to see the fruits of that trajectory. I mean, if you look, for instance, at the breakdown in the food system, the fact that we have gutted regulations, we don't allow enough, there's not enough allocation for proper inspection, we have the dumping of antibiotics and hormones through waste products into the water system. I mean, just you can go on and on listing these things. They all result from the same thing. Profit is placed above national wellness. And I think the struggle that the United States is going to face is really, this is the struggle. On the one side, you have those who, for reasons of ideology or theology, place profit as the first consideration. And against that, you have those who are trying to structure a society in which wellness is the first priority so that individuals can develop their potential. And when they are able to develop their potential, a healthy middle class develops. And when a healthy middle class develops, a healthy society develops. We need a government that is significantly larger than something you can drown in a bathtub. A nation of 311 million people require that certain general systems like the highway system, the food system, the healthcare system are operated in a healthful way. And we don't have that now. And I think that is our central struggle.
Let's take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment and continue the conversation with Stephen Schwartz.
He said, "Fear me again. No, I'm your father. Remember that no one can breathe underwater."
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And we are continuing the conversation with Stephen Schwartz, who's a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research. He's also the editor of the daily web publication, SchwartzReport.net. where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, and other publications. Welcome back on this Christmas Day, Stephen Schwartz. And just before the break, you were talking about that there are 311 million people in the United States. There are only 4.3 million members of the National Rifle Association, according to their own website's figures published at the NRA's website. So that means that the NRA is really a part of the 1%. So how do they have this inordinate political power and political influence on Capitol Hill?
Because the corporations that make the armaments pay enormous sums to lobbyists and support those congressional members who adhere to their program. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. The rush of money that has poured into our political system, something the founders never conceived of, has produced exactly the kind of results you would expect. Those people who have vast sums of money can achieve the goals that they want, and they make sure that if you have the control of the legislature, you're not going to break the law because you're going to write the law. And that's exactly what's happened. It's preposterous. I mean, there are other countries that have as high or nearly as high a level of arms within the private sector, in the public sector, but they do not have the same kinds of murder rates that we do. And part of this is, I think the NRA is right. I think video games and other things, there are some studies that show that they do excite a certain small percentage of people, and it's that same small percentage of people who cause problems. But it's not principally video games, as they would describe it. It's not principally violent movies. But it is a toleration at the cultural level of a certain macho armed man idea that allows people to obtain weapons, you know, the 40% of the market that is not controlled because it goes through the gun shows and online. I published something the other day about this, an essay about this that I wrote, and one of my readers wrote me and said he'd spent 15 minutes on Google, and in the 15 minutes he had been able to find a source for assault weapons, silencers, special armor-piercing bullets, and hand grenades. That was in 15 minutes on Google. So that kind of approach to weaponry clearly is not serving us well. And if we had the same activity going on in another part of our culture, we'd be having enormous outrage. I mean, if you had high school coaches that were shooting their players or something, you know, there'd be enormous outcry. But we have developed a kind of tolerance for the murder of innocents in order to protect a small group of people, and even an even smaller group of people, because it's really not just any gun. It's particularly these assault weapons with these huge magazines and multiple weapons that people go around carrying. The idea that we should have a more armed society is, I think, truly socially insane, and really ought to be seen almost as a psychiatric problem.
Well, if the logic of the NRA and the gun defenders of so-called gun rights, who've somehow conflated guns with the Constitution, if their argument completely falls apart, because, you know, if everybody's armed and there are 300 million guns in the United States, according to their logic, the United States should be the safest place on the planet. And it is clearly not. It is the least safe in terms. And if your children are even safe at school, then we really do have a problem. But again, it gets back to this idea that a handful of people can buy the legislature, they can buy the government against the will of the vast majority. And so I guess the only way to fix that system is to take money out of politics, right?
Well, I think part of it is taking money out of politics, yes. But the other part of it is developing a national consensus that social wellness in the broad, I don't just mean physical wellness, I mean psychological wellness, financial wellness, that is the first priority. That's what we're striving for. That's what the founders had in mind. What they were trying to construct, it's very clear, you go back and read their material, the diaries, the notes taken at meetings, all of that. It's very clear that the struggle that they were trying to make was, how do you create a system which allows people to rise to their potential in a way that encourages entrepreneurism, but at the same time acknowledges the importance of collectivism? I mean, if you look at Benjamin Franklin, for instance, I mean, he founded the first fire company, the first insurance company, helped with the first hospitals, the first sanitation programs. All of that was designed because, as he said in his will, in a pleasant, supportive social setting, people do better. So he wanted to see parks built and public baths built and sanitation systems built, that sort of thing, because he recognized that it was in the interests of everyone to have an environment which was supportive of wellness. We seem to have lost that to a point where we've really become a kind of aberration of what our original purpose was. And it's not just to make the greatest profit possible. It is to create a society that supports wellness. And if you look at all of the social measures, whether it's health care, infant mortality, maternal mortality, you see the United States ranks way down there. And it's because the choices we make do not support the idea of national wellness. Instead, profit is the only priority we acknowledge. I'm not against profit, but I think you have to make the profit within the context of national wellness. And until we reach that point, we are going to fall further and further behind in all of the social measures that describe a healthy society.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who's a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research. Well, it's pretty clear that, again, you get back to the DNA of our problems, and that is who pays taxes and who doesn't, and how do you have sufficient revenues to run a government that takes care of its people who operate on the simple premise, which is how social democracies operate in other countries, where the citizens pay their taxes and get their government services, and if politicians are good stewards of that tax money and provide good services, they get reelected, and if they don't, they get booted out. And we have politicians who are on the payroll of gun manufacturers and who talk about abortion and prayer and family values and all kinds of extraneous stuff. But what this has led to is a government that is owned by the rich, in as much as, if you go back to ancient Athens, the whole purpose of taxing progressively, meaning that the wealthiest would pay more taxes than the poorest, was based upon the idea that those who had flourished and done well in a society owed that society something for providing them the means with which they have flourished. In other words, the very infrastructure, the roads and buildings and other things that have made the society worthwhile, they all benefit from it. And that was the understanding of that compact. We have lost that, and the wealthy are so detached and arrogant, and the corporate barons are so detached and arrogant that they, create their own world. They'll live in gated communities without potholes, but the rest of us be damned.
Yes. Well, that is what's happening. We have creating one of the collateral effects of the rise of the virtual corporate state, that is, corporations which function essentially as countries but which don't have geography, is that it has created an international uber-rich who really do live in another world. They live in a world of private planes and gated communities and yachts that are over 200 feet and all that. I mean, it is another world. You have a small group of people who control through corporations, which in turn control national legislatures. You have a kind of 1% or a tenth of a percent who really do live in a world utterly different than the world that most of us live in, and who have, because they, you could see this in the last election, in Romney's comments. It wasn't that he was a bad guy. It was that he lived in a world that, I mean, just a lot of us aren't making garages which have elevators for our multiple cars. It's just another world. And when you live in that world, you simply don't interact with the kinds of situations that most people live in. And we have gotten, because those people control increasingly the levers of government, we are creating or have created a world in which great masses of people are struggling. I mean, the fact that we have 17 million children in the United States who experience hunger ought to give us national pause. I mean, that is such a horrifying situation that you would think that people would immediately be reaching out to try to do something about that. And as we sit here on Christmas and think about all the things we just got, think also about the people who didn't get anything or who only got something because some social agency or some volunteer group provided it, because they're really cut out of the network of prosperity and are sort of just left behind. The problem with that is that when you get enough people like that who are left behind, you get enormous social disruption and chaos. And if we don't deal with these issues, I think that's where we're headed. I'm not worried about, and as the CIA report said, I'm not worried about China and the United States going to war, but I am definitely worried about large social disruptions which arise as a result of the stresses that have been created by the misprioritization of the country's assets.
But also it seems that we have created a media culture that exacerbates social tensions and creates a kind of collective paranoia. If you watch the evening news on local news, it's terrifying. It looks like the world is full of rapists and child molesters and hit-and-run drivers and right. People that massacre school children we're terrified that a terrorist is going to get us. And Fox News has had a very, very toxic effect in polarizing the nation's politics to the point now where Washington is broken. So I just wonder what can be done to reverse this process of alienation, because, we just did a piece yesterday where it turns out that 93 million people didn't vote in the last election who could have voted, and we had less people vote in this last election than voted in 2004, in spite of the sense that there was a lot at stake. So, we're basically becoming alienated and atomized.
Yes, I think that's true, and all flowing from this same fundamental problem. We do not make national wellness. I mean, if you sat down and said, well, how can we best structure a society so that everyone can have a decent quality of life and people who are entrepreneurially inclined can really prosper to the fullest, where we recognize that we live in the earth, not on the earth, that we aren't some special category, but that we are part of a larger network of life. How do we do that? And if you sat down and did that, you probably would come up with a democracy, but one which placed the idea of national wellness and planetary wellness as the first priority. How do we, how do you make money within that context? Not how do you make money and, oh, if you happen to produce some positive benefit, well, that's lovely, but that's not really the point. If you look at, for instance, fracking, which I see as the last gasp of old energy, carbon-based energy, it not only isn't going to last very well, because increasingly we're going to move over, as the CIA report noted, into alternative energies, but the problems that fracking is going to leave us with, the pollution of underground aquifers and all of that, that's going to go on for generations. So it occurs because we're not making a principled decision about the policies we should support, which is moving over to alternative energy. I think that climate change is going to create these stressors that are going to finally cause a new set of choices to emerge, the ones that you and I are talking about. There's going to be migration away from the coast because you're not going to be able to get properties insured that are on the coast. Nobody will insure them because of the events that occur. You're going to see a migration out of the southwest because of water and temperature. You're going to see enormous pressures to convert to alternative energies because it's going to become increasingly obvious that carbon-based energy simply is an unsustainable program. But the pain that's going to cause is really the issue. It's not a question of if we're going to do these things. I think the CIA report makes that clear. It's not if. It's when and how much pain we're willing to inflict upon ourselves before we get there. One of the things I think need to happen is to get money out of the political process. It's clear, I think, from what happened in this last election that you can't buy the presidential election, but you can buy the failure of a proposition. The GMO proposition, for instance, failed almost certainly because of the huge sums of money that were pumped in. So you can't get the presidency, but you can certainly get things at the state, local, and regional level. And until we remove the influence of money, I don't think we're going to be able to solve these problems, because you're a congressman and somebody comes to you and offers enormous sums of money to finance your next election or whatever. It's very hard to say no. We need to take the people are people. We need to take the temptation out of the system.
Well, Stephen Schwartz, I thank you very much for joining us here today on this Christmas Day.
Merry Christmas to you, Ian. May it be a wonderful new year for you and me and all your listeners.
Well, thank you again. And I've been speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who's a senior fellow at the Samueli Institute and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Change. He is also the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, the Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, and other publications. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, and the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.